Philosophy 58, May 10th, 1954.
No self has a history. The history, gentlemen, of the human spirit, as I've tried to show you, is the history of speech. From the very first, people tried to name themselves and be named in the history of all mankind. If you say Jupiter, or you say Java, or you say America, it is the name you want to be recognized with by other peoples. So the first thing an American wants to be known for is that a Russian has to call him an American. If you try to write a natural history of America, for whom do you write it? You obviously think that a Russian should say, this is the real history of the American people. Now, if you can force upon the Russians such a thought, then you have existed for them. And they are part of your story and you are part of their story. If you can force down the throat of the Europeans that the American have a history by itself, no European believes that for that matter, because they know too well that you all came from Europe. So they think that we are ramifications of European history, which is probably true. But the naivety, the selfishness of America comes out today in these frantic efforts of having an American history department. This is your decision, gentlemen. History is always an article of faith. Those of you who have heard taken philosophy 57 know that this is the fundamental recognition which a man who has any mind of his own must make, that history has to do with the future. You only have as much history as you have future. Most people have no future, therefore to them history is a zoological garden or museum or like the history museum in New York City, which is hang full of potteries, as you know. All the good alleged great painters of the world are represented in this museum in New York City, but by potteries, by imitations. And I'm afraid that the American history, if you treat it as a past without a future, is all forgery. What you think of the Puritans, for example, is all forgery. Because you have written off the Puritans, you think they are not the future of America. You laugh at them. You say, oh, the Puritans, but we are real swines. And therefore you say swines, of course, don't have the Puritans as ancestors, but just as mockers. And that's how you mock the Puritans, instead of being proud of them. And if I hear people today talk of the Puritans, I always feel that these people are cutting off the branch on which they themselves are sitting and have no future because they deny their past. Very simple. So this decision, where American history is, has to do, of course, with your knowledge what history is, gentlemen. Anybody who thinks that a part of the events of human life are not natural events but historical events believes in direction and believes that the whole past is the beginning of our your and my future, and that you have to know of the past all those things which are steps into our and mine and your children's future. Everything else can be dismissed. For example, you can dismiss past steps. They don't belong in the universal history because the children may very well do with a rubber tub instead. Bathtubs are not essential. In Harvard, however, they teach a course in universal history in which Blackstock in New York Street is an essential epoch in American history. That's the degradation which you find in this country at this moment, that something purely casual, accidental, and transient is made epochal. How can the invention of Blackstock be epochal, gentlemen, since we have every right to forget about it? Next thing we fly. And what about blacktop then? No blacktop in the sky. But the brain of this country, you see, has been lowered to below the plumber. And you really think that in things, the epochs of history can be expressed. They cannot. Can be superseded, gentlemen, and in history only begin remain those things which cannot be superseded. That you call your father father cannot be superseded, because otherwise you cannot know what a son and what a father is, or what a mother is, or a daughter. Therefore, the invention of the tribes to call each other with lasting names is an eternal one, and that's epoch. And you remember our first chapter where, therefore, great period where people gave names to places and rivers, and you know people have still a feeling of the sanctity of this, because we still say Connecticut River. That is, we to this day have kept the Indian names of the people who gave these places their first names. We feel we must not destroy this. That's so creative and so imaginative that you and I are quite pleased that we live around Winnipesaukee and Sunapee and Connecticut, you see. And the White River compared to that, well, look at White River Junction, you see. Have you ever understood this, gentlemen, that the tribal age is the great heroic age of name-giving, and that neither you or I have the imagination today to give such wonderful names? I think I told you this terrible story of the governor, of course it was of Texas, who called his name was Hogg, Governor Hogg, and he resented it, and so he called his first daughter, I am a Hogg, and his second daughter, you are a Hogg. And degraded, therefore, the art of name-giving and the religion of name-giving into a game. And I'm afraid that's by and large how you treat sex and marriage today. Shamelessly and namelessly. Because shame and name go together, gentlemen. Where there is no name, there is no shame. And this is shameless to call your daughter, you are a hog and I am a hog, and you should be a hog. Well, it isn't so ridiculous. It is the ultimate of degradation. I just received a letter today from a lady on her deathbed. She has a dangerous operation. She's 24 years of age and 25. And she confessed that in England they had reached that state of degradation that they were two girls. One was the mistress of her friend, and she was only a girlfriend of this gentleman in one of the houses. And in the presence of this other girl, who was a dancer, this boy began to tell her how the dancer behaved in the most intimate embrace. Now, this degradation, you see, that's typical of you and your generation. There's absolutely nothing sacred anymore. Once you can speak in the presence of one girl about the sexual behavior of another girl, then you're counted out of history. You have lost all creative powers. I assure you that has nothing to do with any orgies or so. Everything is forgiven, only not shamelessness. Because it leads to namelessness. These girls are numbers. Just in a number game. And this boy and the two girls, I'm afraid too, are out of luck. They're just on the dunghill. They cannot feel. I don't think they can hear. Perhaps the girl by riding me and breaking down and weeping, because I have composed a disc in which these things are mentioned, and she now tells me that she has far exceeded the shamelessness I have mentioned on this disc. But I think it concerns you too much. You too are absolute lousy. And it begins with Governor Hall, who probably was a prude and not a tallest man, by calling his daughter, you are a whore. That's forbidden. That is forbidden. With names, there's no joking. And in this country, you think you can do as you please. And any anybody who thinks he can do as you please ceases to be interesting. Decent people ask what they have to do. And as soon as a man says, I'm independent, I can do as I please, forget about it. He's not interested. I hope you will never have neighbors who think they can do as they please. It's impossible to live with such neighbors. And this is, therefore, your real predicament. If you have a natural history of America, you will only hear of the Colorado Gold Rush or the Alaska Gold Rush or the Wild West. And the whole show that is shown you in this country always suggests that people did but do as they please. Do you think that the 48 states of the Union have been built by people who did as they please? The Chief Justice of England came one day to Nebraska, and he visited the Chief Justice of Nebraska in Lincoln. The son of this Chief Justice was present and became later the most famous professor of law in the United States. And the son has told me the story. And he said the two old gentlemen were debating, and the Justice from England said rather condescendingly, now how did these people in Nebraska find what was just, and how could they write a constitution? Really, I'm flabbergasted that here out in the West you were able to know what is right. And the Chief Justice of Lincoln, Nebraska, rose in all his height and thundered at this Chief Justice and said, well, maybe that in England the simple people do not know what is right and what has to be done, but I assure you, in Nebraska they still pretty well know what has to be done. And Roscoe Pound, who told me the story, as I said, became the greatest jurist in this country because he knew that the law is in every man's heart. And it is in a father's heart not to dishonor his girl by calling her you are a whore. That is not a joke. That's something to make you weep over the waste and destruction in this country. This country is degenerate, absolutely degenerate, because of these circumstances. Ask anybody in this country, gentlemen, what's your idea? If he tells you, I want to do what I please, say, you can be a mosquito, but you can't be a human being. And they are mosquitoes, these animals, who do as they please. They bite. And your idea is this. You want to have the much money so you can buy all the women in the world, all the cars in the world, all the golf sticks in the clubs in the world, and all the countries of the world. You call that power. And you forgive everybody of this zest for power. Nothing but criminal. But there is in every hour of life, gentlemen, that has to be done, gentlemen. We are in the throes of this tremendous change from Greece to Egypt in this country. Now I come back to my strange, miraculous American history, which is, so to speak, in reverse order. Beginning with the end of time, with the coming of Christ into this world, and then creating out of nothing, out of the desert, out of this New England beach, this bleak beach. It's really not a very attractive country, you know, Rock Horse, Plymouth Rock. And you know the people in California say that if the California, they had known there was a California, New England would have never been settled. And there's something in it. With that climate, 9 months winter and 3 months no summer. But they came came here on an errand which was more important than the weather. They didn't come to have the sun and Isis of Egypt. They didn't come for the harvest. But they did come for freedom and for the rebirth of this freedom. And so we said this was an errand in the wilderness meant for the rest of the world as a beacon, as a missionary church. And so in this newest, latest, most refined and most ultimate era, America was founded as the non plus ultra in Christianity. Then, when the time delayed out of this so to speak, how would you call it, this outlook, this our lookout post into Europe, came running into this country as a promised land, and we get the 18th century as the promised England, a God's country here, and you know that that's a time of the piety of the revivalists and of the religious faith of this country. And by 1776, the country goes secular, and we said it goes Greek. The Freemasons are the expression of the Greek character of the United States. And you get the Star Spangled Banner, and you get the golden cupola of the classic Capitol in every state. And this strange interest in Greek pillars and Roman senates and expressions of political life. Every word of our political language is Latin and Greek. And every word of our religion is biblical. And I said to you, but this isn't the whole story. Democracy is pluralistic. Many states. America still was in the 19th century the champion of the small nations. We aren't any longer, as you see in Indochina. We are no longer the champions of the small nations. All of a sudden, what has happened? We have ceased to be Greeks. We have also ceased to be Jews. We have perhaps nearly ceased to be Christians. That I do not believe, because the whole tendency is still fulfillment of the whole revelation of Christianity. But we are at this moment trying to get this country into its proper place in the universe. And we said that's orientation. And orientation is the history of the empire. And orientation means to have an eternal settlement, a fixed place. And the best argument for this fact that we have are now reached a quite a different phase is, for example, that practically nobody can emigrate from this country anywhere else. It's equally bad everywhere now. Conscription is everywhere, taxes are everywhere too high, and if you want to be a pacifist in this country, you have no other country to go to, you see, to be a pacifist. You better stay here in a still the best place to be, even with conscription at the law. I told you the story of the men who wanted to his son and his congregation to remain able to leave this country in 1936. It's all over now. There is no country to which he could go. Even in Paraguay they have conscription. But this means, gentlemen, that America no longer is Greek, because the Greeks set the scene. The Greeks had the islands, the Greeks had the colonies, and therefore the Greeks had an endless chain of expanse. The world was all before them, where to choose, where this from. That's a quotation. The world was all before them, where to choose. No? And Providence their God. No, gentlemen, who is Major in English? No deep recollection?
At least.
What?
At least.
Hmm? The last verse of Milton's Paradise Lost.
He certainly is more quoted than read, Mr. Milton, isn't it?
Orientation, gentlemen, is the problem of the Egyptian and prosperity, security, and the victory over the business cycle. These are our tasks today. And as I told you, they came about in three great steps. In the Spanish-American War as a prelude, in the First World War as getting involved with the whole world, and with the Second World War as getting the whole world around us. In the First World War, we moved into the world, but I'm afraid in the Second World War, by our own astute inventing of the right bombs, we, the world, moved in upon us. As you know, we are have now the whole world around us. I think it's a joke that this lady wrote the book, The Sea Around Us. And that's small comfort. The sea may still be around us, but other things are also around us. And that's much more pertinent. We are now surrounded by something that is neither continent nor sea, but aggression and neighborhood and enemy. And we cannot be defended. I don't think any country is so vulnerable than the United States. You see, nobody is going to destroy Europe because both sides want to have it. The Russians will never bomb Germany because they want to inherit the rule. So the Germans have at this moment a privileged situation. There will be no atomic bomb ever loosened on Europe. But you may be sure it will be loosened on Detroit and Pittsburgh. Because there's no mercy. With the Russians, they have no feelings. They can't inherit it, so let's destroy it, they will say. But about Europe, if you, I were you, I would buy a little castle in France. That's the same. And Germany is still safer because the Russians are quite sure that one day they'll get it. So they won't destroy it. But we are absolutely, you see, we thought the world around us, and now I'm very serious, gentlemen. The Americans had the idea they went into the world wars. And that's why the Dresden was destroyed. As you know, in Dresden there were twice as many people killed as in Hiroshima. But everybody in this country only speaks of the atom bomb on Hiroshima, but he doesn't speak of the completely senseless destruction of Dresden, where in one night 160,000 people were killed, and which is every day in every Russian broadcast the great point of attack against America. They say we'll never have done this. This is was madness, insanity, arrogance, cruelty, whatnot. And you must know this, that every European knows about these Russian broadcasts against our destruction of Dresden, which has never been justified, which was probably just the English air marshals tell us bloodthirstiness. Nobody quite knows why it was done. Absolutely meaningless. Much more meaningless than the atom bomb over Hiroshima, because at least Hiroshima frightened the Japanese in would think into immediate surrender. It isn't true because they had surrendered before, as you know, offered their surrender before, and we just threw it for technical curiosity to see how it works. Yes, I'm afraid so. The technicians wanted to know what it does, so they thought they had to destroy this. They said it wasn't necessary. The Japanese had announced their unconditional surrender before. So, we are so wonderful people. You see, we are the great humanitarians. We are so good, wonderfully good while we are in school. And outside school, we are so wonderfully bad. But if you hear the Americans talk to each other, they are the most good-natured people in the world. Are they? I think they are the most panicky people in the world. And then they do many stupid things like Hiroshima or prison. But you can prove it to yourself, gentlemen, there was something that we hadn't foreseen. America went into the world wars as though it went out into the world. And the result is that the war came home. And now we feel that the world is coming to us. And this is a tremendous transition. If you think of the Spanish-American War and see the noise Mr. Theodore Roosevelt then made with his Rough Riders, it was just going out, you see, for a nice little country, out, away from America. And then you get the World Wars, the Crusade of the Star-Spangled Banner, and then you get the Second Crusade of Eisenhower, Crusade in Europe, they call it, in which term it is clearly said, we at home have nothing to do with this, it's a crusade in Europe. And what's the result, gentlemen? That this far world, 3,000 miles from here, 8,000 miles from here, in the Pacific and across the Atlantic, to which we went for justice and for mercy and for many good reasons, by the way, that this world suddenly declared, well, if you come to us, we must turn the tables on you and say, may we not come to you. This is the nervousness of America. This is Mr. McCarthy in a nutshell, what he really has to complain of and what, why the people, I mean, felt for him was that there was a sudden feeling that this whole situation of the United States now is totally changed. The United States are inside the world. And before the world was all before us, we had to choose, and Providence sake our guide. So Milton's Paradise Lost, you see, and is now in reverse. That's there how Paradise Lost ends. I don't think that we can say Paradise Gained or regained. It's very bitter. It's the one situation for which this country, gentlemen, is utterly unprepared. To be inside of the world. We have called this country the New World. We have allowed the rest of the world to emigrate to the United States. I have come to this country as a New World, far from Europe, to protect myself and my family. And your ancestors have all come in the same idea, to get out. And now, I'm afraid we are in. We are very much inside. We have a bridge between the North Pole and the Panama Canal, and obviously both are the first points of attack in any war. And inside we are. And this is what I would say the new application, gentlemen, of the ancient experience of the eternal settlement. Of just being there where we are, and we can't escape. Everybody knows that there is no escape from these new forms. You're just there and have to sit it out as a very lame duck. Of course, we here are still relatively safe, if I may, go to darkness. I mean, if you want to escape, we are so insignificant they won't waste the bomb on us. What I cannot help admiring in this great plan of Providence, gentlemen, is this rediscovery of all the ways of creation in America and from America. I have tried to tell you that first Israel was rediscovered, then Greece was rediscovered, and now we discover all the problems of a big empire. We don't call it this way because we don't like to be reminded of the British Empire. Don't call it this way, but certainly Mr. Eisenhower is a big feeder, a large feeder, a great feeder, however he turns out to be. Prosperity first. The farmers and the workers look for him for money, for wages. The other for business. Then that has nothing to do with a Greek governor or king or mayor of Athens, where the I told you the citizens were responsible for the business cycle and not the government. But that's new. And as you know, the Republicans tried to get out of this responsibility and liberalize the farmers, and they just couldn't do it. And now they are settled, as you know, with the stores of Egypt of 1 billion bushels wheat in surplus. It has never happened in the history of the world. that a whole million bushels of wheat are just there to be stored. It cannot be used next year. It's just reserved. So we are really repeating the great Fearoni experiment. I wonder what we're going to do, whether we are going to feed the hungry or whether we are going to spoil the stomachs of the satiated. When Hitler and Lenin appeared on the scene 20 years ago, the world seemed to plunge into tribalism, into clanism, into the prehistoric interests of the classless society. You may know that the Marxians proclaimed that they were going back to prehistoric men, to the times before the classes appeared in history, and they wanted to give back to men this wonderful all-roundness of primitive man. You don't know this perhaps, but in the Marxian program of the parties in the various countries, all the research on clans and tribes and early anthropology has played a decisive part. I myself was a victim of one such battle, being a reactionary all the time, by the ultra-socialists in Germany, who deposed me because in the institution which I headed, I would not pay lip service to this necessary return of primitive tribalism. At that time, they were putting in their party program of the left wing of the Marxian parties in Germany the newest discoveries on primitive men, of the times when there were no classes in society, no exploitation. So this is Hitler, as you know, with his race ideas, is the same, purity of race, every group secluded, completely separate by itself, primitive man, and he said that the in times in between were abolished. And all over the world, gentlemen, the entrance, the last 40 years have been celebrated by eager scribes and stump speakers as a return to the common man, to the classless society, and to the early days of, well, natural man, maybe. I myself attended a strange scene in this country. I went to the Congress of the Historians. I had been asked to deliver there an evening address. You stood there in long-tailed coat and white tie. And there was one more man invited, Benedetto Croce, but he couldn't come from Italy. And his address was read, and then came James Preston. Who has heard of James Preston in this country? Only one? The Egyptologist, a charming man. He has founded the Oriental Institute in Chicago, and has written this famous book, The Dawn of Consciousness. Don't you know that? Who has heard of the Dawn of Consciousness? See? I thought that was generally. Now, as all liberal modern scholars in this country, was a great fool. And he said about history. And he said, gentlemen, we can forget the 4,000 years of revolution, and we can link Franklin D. Roosevelt and his social idealism directly with the Egyptian pharaohs and their social idealism 4,000 years back. He literally told the historians that they should extrapolate 4,000 years of history. Now, he did nothing more in his gibberish than what the Marxians said in more greater fanaticism and still say, that men must get before the class society, into the classless society, as it was in the beginning of history. And here you have then Hitler, you have Lenin, Marx, and you have Mr. Preston for America, all in the beginning of this crisis in which we live, advocating and a return before Greece, before Christianity, and before Israel. You may be sure that there is then something, some point of this. I haven't invented this story, this picture, this strange going backward in order to go forward. You remember what we said in this course, that man, in order to go forward, kept his head turned backward. Now, the decision you and I have to make is now the following. There's no doubt that we go from Israel and from Homer to prehistoric, pre-Homeric men. We go back to Egypt, the exodus of Egypt, and the Trojan War, gentlemen. We are the limits of life with which people reckoned in the 19th century. Your great grandfathers were perfectly satisfied when they read the Bible and Homer. That was all they wanted to know about prehistoric, the beginnings of men on this earth. We are not satisfied. We want to go back a whole thousands or 2,000 or 3,000 years before Homer and before the Bible. And as I told you, there is a unanimous consent on this between the fascists, the liberals, and the communists. Now, if you get such a threefold agreement, you have to prick up your ears and say, this is irresistible. And this little number of decent people in the middle called the Church of Christ, or the living believers, is hard put by these three tremendous heresies. The liberal heresy, the fascist heresy, and the communist heresy. All at this moment say, the last 4,000 years are superfluous, or they are bad, or they are class war, or they are dark, like the Dark Ages, or they are dogmatic, or ecclesiastic, or prejudiced and superstitious. And we must go get out of religion, and get out of revelation, get out of dogma, and get out of class. However they formulate it, they want to cancel 4,000 years of human life on this earth. And if it is there, you are exactly right. The Trojan War is 1184 BC. The Moses, obviously, is around 1280 to 1380. The fall of Jericho can quite well be dated. Abraham may be 1700 BC. Now, if you then put together 1954 and 1500 BC, where do we get? We get to 3,500 years, at least, that are extrapolated and declared to be rotten, so to speak. And all these three want to go back to these, you see, flesh pots of Egypt or to the tribes. Now, today I want to apply all this, gentlemen. You hear this in the papers, you never take this seriously, but you are made by these slogans. This is why we have the FEC. That is why the stock exchange from a nice Greek stock exchange, in which you really can make money, now is absolutely controlled by the government, you see. All the nice joke is out of it, you see. You can't become now a billionaire overnight anymore, because you have really to have the cash to trade on the stock exchange. Greece is over. The whole speculation is over. It's very tiresome now. You can't make more than 12%. But in 1880, you could become rich fabulously overnight. Fortuna, the wheel of fortune was called, and that's Greece. That's the trade-off. And that was sealed, and that was considered great. The robber barons, you know all these pieces. This is very Greek. The heroes in Homer, they were all great speculators in war booty, you know. They also said, hey, let us have war, otherwise we can't have prosperity. Like the people in New York now say, as strugglers of the 19th century. We must have war, because otherwise we can't earn money. I attended a meeting in Greenfield, here, down the Connecticut River, where there were three honorable businessmen from New York City. This is 2 years ago. It's hard to believe. And they sat there and told the citizens of Greenfield that, of course, we had to have war, because otherwise our economy ashamed of yourself. They went. They didn't know better. Everybody in New York at that time had this stupidity, this crazy. You have had some stupidity every half year in New York. At that time, it wasn't there. You wouldn't believe it. It's forgotten. But 2 years ago, any man who came from New York said that we must have war because otherwise we would have a depression. And of course, the Russians knew this and feared this and thought we would go to war. And that's why the whole war scare comes from war. But they heard these people at the stock exchange trying to prolong the liberal Greek era of pre-war days. You see? Now we must live quite differently. The Egyptians didn't have to go to war in order to have prosperity. And that's why this new empire building is very serious for us. It means you have to arrange things in such a way that we can have prosperity without war. It hasn't been served yet. But we have to do it. You see, we have to have now a TV-style economy, and the armaments cannot finance this country, obviously, because we have to finance the armaments. But if you hear these silly people talk, they really think that the armaments should finance the economy. You see how mad they are? Stand on their head. The armaments are going to finance the economy. If you don't see the craziness of this, I can't help you, see. But that is once you are obsessed by one-way street mind, that trading is the basis of prosperity. So whatever you sell, whether it's debts of the government, bonds of the government, you still trade, you see. And if a broker at the stock exchange sells 2 billion bonds of the government bonds, he still thinks that he is going to be rich. Perhaps he is, but the government is going to be poor because it has sold what hasn't sold. Debt, you see. It has signed up for more debts and more debts. Well, all this is only, these are little examples. You know many more yourself, but you never apply them to the fact that in this country at this moment the Greek mind or the Republican mind is at war with the new mind, which is the mind of permanent settlement, which is cuts out the unexpected gains of new discovered lands, of new discovered oil drills, gold mines and so on. It says we can't live by gold rushes in Alaska or oil drills in Texas or even in Aramco. We must live on a basis where we make an honest living year in, year out. That's our problem. It's not an expanding economy, gentlemen. It's very naive. An expanding economy is only possible if you think that part of the world is not known. If you think that you can move into infinite space. Once you're pinned down in a corner and nowhere else but where you are, life's very different. That's our problem at this moment. And that's why you get the absolute insanity in the intellectual and political circles of this country, because they don't know where they live. They are torn between their 18th century background of revival Methodism and their Greek tradition of liberalism, you see, and the real demands of the hour today of quite a new stage in history. And you hear these people talk, and they go on Sunday to the cathedral in Washington and hear one thing, you see. And then they go to the stock exchange and read what's happening there. Then they hear Leon Greek. And then they hear what Mr. John Lewis has to tell them the next day, and the farmers of America. And then in their despair, they have a Senate hearing just to idle away the time, because they don't want to talk any of the three serious business, what religion they have, what politics they have, what economy they have. They prefer instead to have some fun, clear fun, but not clean. And that's the McCarthy era, sir. That's escapism. That's dealing with absolutely nothing, with fraud. Thank you. because people don't know how serious the adaptation is to which they will have to come. They will have to digest a new epoch in American history. And that's very difficult. And very difficult. And you have to believe in God in order to digest, and you have to believe that nobody can do as he pleases. That there is a world created by our Maker which waits to be fulfilled. And the United States, who were only so far, had only been required to reciprocate with the Christian Church and Jerusalem and Athens, now are required suddenly to reproduce the empires of old and the tribes of old and to build a great society. And you remember we said the church has been built in the 1,000 years. And the states have been built in the 2,000 years. And in the 3,000 year there must be built the society. Now one thing, however, can I give you as our comfort. The United States have done a very good job in preventing the relapse in direct relapse into tribalism. Hitler has been defeated, and I still think that's highly meritorious. If you hear this from Mr. McCarthy, you will think it is very much to be regretted that Hitler was defeated, because his inspiration is certainly Hitler's Mein Kampf, Hitler's, you see, that is Mr. McCarthy's textbook. I know it from the person in his own hometown who told us that he shut himself up for a fortnight with Hitler's book and then came out and said, that is it. Now tribalism, gentlemen, seemed to the Russians as well as to Hitler the immediate issue that is from liberalism, from Greecism, from humanism, which is all Greek and Roman, you see, they wanted to go back to primitive men. I've quoted you this before. We have forced the world first to consider the Egyptian issue of a division of labor, of which the tribes are completely untouched. And you know the Russians, to their own dismay, also could not free labor but have to enslave it. There is more class in Russia than anywhere else at this moment, because the division of labor is their problem. And the division of labor is the Egyptian problem, as you remember. It is not the tribal problem. The tribe has only organized marriage and war. Egypt has organized castes and classes and vocations and professions and specializations. Now, you see, take down this one thing, gentlemen. The two world wars have forced the world not back into tribalism, but into a more complex division of labor than ever before. There are more sharper class lines than ever before in the world. The opposite has happened from what the Russians wanted to do. Why? Because at this moment, the complications of production make it more necessary than ever to particularize and to grow in such a way that we form teams in which one man does something quite different from the other. And the more you have to distinguish what one man does and the other, the more you move into Egypt and the less you are in a tribe, at home in a tribe. In any clan, in any tribe, every warrior can be a singer and a dancer and a warrior and a father and a son and a medicine man and everything. But in an economy of the settlement type, one is a builder and one is a priest and a stargazer and the other is a scientist and the other is a jeweler and everybody does something different. You remember? Therefore, gentlemen, the two world wars, by interpolating the United States into the suicide of Europe, have prevented Europe from going tribal. They have said, slowly, please, slowly. There is some other phase which we have to build in first. In your Marxian theory, you've forgotten that. You wanted to go on from capitalism straight away into tribal. They call it socialism or communism. There is something in between. You can't go from Greece to the Iroquois or the Algonquin Indians. You have to go from Greece into Egypt. So I think that's very practical for you and me. You see, we are, at this moment, the destiny of America is retarded. We have to delay the wild dances by which the peoples of the Marxian demonism, so to speak, want to dance back into primitivism right away. And by our very existence, we prove to them that the problem of economy comes first. And the problem of integration is still far away at this moment, you see, of integration in the warrior sense of the tribe, where everybody, you see, is everything and everybody. You are not going to be everybody. You will be very pleased if you have a job. Be all around men. And you will have to find at least 73 different hobbies in order to make up for that. So far away are we from the dream of 1914, gentlemen, of the common man, that the time of the total revival of the dawn of life on this earth of primitive man was around the corner. We still have plenty of time. We have obviously still 1,000 years of revival of the old empire. Perhaps not 1,000 years, I don't know the time. But this then makes you perhaps feel that this is a religious issue, gentlemen. If you have faith in America's place in the world, you will suddenly understand that America now, for the first time in our consciousness, is born with a strangely conservative mission. The other nations, gentlemen, are hurrying quicker to the beginning of time back in their consciousness than we are allowed to do. You must be satisfied at this moment to build Boulder Dam, the modern pyramid, so to speak, an Empire State Building. And you have to tell the Russians that they better build things instead of dancing frantically around a maypole. It isn't the shouting today and the enthusiasm that is needed, but it is the patient division of labor all over the world. A checkerboard, so to speak, of countries which support each other. You have to find out what is best done where. And then I think we quite ruthlessly must say to each other that the country that not every country should probably be industrialized. You see in the Argentina business. The Argentinians have said every country must be like everybody, every other country. We must not produce meat for England, but machinery for Argentina. You know, that's a big issue in Argentina. There you have a very clear problem of the which has to be decided. I don't know the decision, but you and I will have to make the decision. As every one of us will contribute to this, you see. Is the whole world going to be equally industrialized and agricultural, you see? Or can there be a specification? Can a prairie produce something else than a garden? And can a garden produce something else than a desert? And can a desert produce something else than a mountain? Range, you see, these are the big problems today. If you talk to the fascists, they want to have it everywhere alive, you see. They want to have a factory in the garden, in the cornfield, wheat field, you see, in every patch of the globe. That's the Egyptian issue. Because the Egyptian issue makes a decision in which part of the globe this and this has to be grown, and in which part something else. So at this moment, gentlemen, if I were young, I would study economy, but on a much larger scale than the so-called economists of the 19th century. They were just the apologetics, the apologetics of the robber barons, the economists of the 19th century. Who are these people?
von Müller to Mr. Tausig and to Mr. Ricardo and to Mr. Adam Smith.
Really, the dependence of the robber barons. That's much more serious than the economy is a great science, because economy is the science of the necessary division of labor in mankind. And we are far from knowing all about it. For example, gentlemen, in our enthusiasm, we have given up the division of labor between women and men. Except that if these are womenless, we think they can do everything, and it won't be long that we think that the men can bring the children into the world, and the women can, I won't say what. Everything is topsy-turvy today because the first division of labor between the sexes has been given up. The second division of labor between the ages has been given up. The people here treat you as though you were, I was just a slot machine and you were doing the teaching as well as the learning. That's the idea of progressive education, as you know. And so we have no division of labor at this moment. It is forgotten. Because the first division of labor is between the sexes, the second is between the ages, and the third is between the talents, you see. But this is all denied in this country. And yet, if you have not a basis, a deep insight into what God meant to do when He created us men and women, we probably cannot understand why He created prairies and mountains. This is all to do with a certain respect, not for the decent opinion of mankind, you see, but for the decent reality of the earth. Are the women the same as the men? Is it desirable that every woman makes a living of her own, you see, leaves the home and dumps the children in a nursery? Have these poor children to be educated by psychologists and teachers? And have the grown-ups to be educated by psychologists? This is all because we have no division of labor. You have a magician for, in every year, 10 years ago it was the dietitian who told you how to live. Now it's the psychoanalyst who tells you how to live. I don't know what in 10 years will be the latest fad to whom you carry your money, but you have no division of labor. If you look around today, the psychoanalyst tells the judge, the psychoanalyst tells the minister, the psychoanalyst tells everybody that he's the only clergy we have at this moment. That's the medicine man of the tribe. That's what he is. And the other, the division of labor is not believed in, because nobody goes to the minister for his sins. He goes to the psychoanalyst. And I'm afraid the minister goes too. Yes, there is no divided authority, gentlemen, but there is only at every one moment a fad, which means there is no division of labor. I want to only to point out to you, gentlemen, in the division of labor, we believe in God's creation, or we don't believe in God's creation. That is, the division of labor, as the Egyptians saw it and discovered it for the first time, is one of the elementary secrets of our existence on this world. I want to exalt it into something. You must not treat us as a superstition. If you hear of Egyptian darkness or the thresholds of Egypt, you think I disparage this. But we are marching into this as a profound secret. We wouldn't have Mr. Perón in Argentina if this wasn't the problem today. Mr. Perón is our enemy. He hates the United States because he says, you have treated Argentina like a just and rural, you see, raw material producing country. We are your equals. We have just as much the know-how of engineers and workers as you have in the United States. Now that's a serious problem. You cannot brush it aside and say, I'm content. We may lose all of South America to Mr. Perón in the next 30 years. Some of these states are just getting ready. They don't want us. As you know, we are not very liked in South America. And certainly, the fact that there are 23 independent states is purely Greek and purely accidental, and that will only be an attribute of the 19th century in South America. It will vanish. There was a boy in this college 10 years ago who had a stipend, a fellowship for studying South America, and he is as a senior fellow. He did what he thought this way. He had a wonderful time. And very joyfully at the end, he read a paper to us on South America, in which he took it for granted that there were these 23 democracies, how he called these despotic tyrannies in Peru, etc. And he said, they are aware, and we have to protect them, and we have to love them, and we have to lend them money. Well, one of my colleagues very wisely objected and said, do you think that money lenders are very much liked by the people who borrow the money? Well, he was a little embarrassed. Then I asked the question, do you really believe that God meant South America to consist of 23 states? And he said, of course, they must be there forever. That's a great mind. He joined, absolutely joined. The sooner Paraguay ceases to exist, the better it is. Terrible state. Most tragic state perhaps on the whole globe. If you read the history of Paraguay, you really wonder why people live in states. Has anybody ever heard something about the history of Paraguay? You know, there at one time there were, I think, 40 male people left in Paraguay, 1840 or 1845. Everybody else was slaughtered, just women and children left. Well, what I'm going to say is, you see, this change of the whole map of the world from Greek free city-states into vast empires is going on under our noses. And as I said, if we do not take this seriously and find the language of beauty and belief in this new order of things, we lose South America, and we lose Middle America, and we lose Mexico. And then where will we be? We will be a tiny spot in the universe exposed to all the cobalt bombs from where they may come. They will come from South America too. There at that time, when we are completely isolated. Because you see, it's so wonderful. All these words come always home to roost. We are now isolationists, you see. Mr. McCormick in Chicago is. But the poor man, I wouldn't like to be the successor of Mr. McCormick in editing the Chicago Herald Tribune. He'll be haunted and visited by the fact that he'll be isolated. You see, it's very nice to be intentionally an isolationist, because that means we can do as we please. But how about being isolated against our will from the rest of the world as a tiny speck on the globe? Now, if Mexico goes, gentlemen, and if Middle America goes and South America goes, because they must unite, and you prevent them, because we believe stoically in the anarchy of 23 eternally warring South American republics. They must unite. The question is only whether they unite with us or with Mr. Perón. And we are obsolete at this moment. We have no policy to explain this to them or to ourselves. You people don't learn it. You don't think about it. You have absolutely obsolete slogans in politics at this moment, I'm afraid to say. I'm sorry that there is no attack. I want to wake you up to the fact that you still have to digest the two world wars. This coming into the world, you see, and the world coming to us, and all of a sudden everything being less important than the fact, how do we divide our labors? That's involved in the Marshall Plan. It's involved in the 4-H program. All these things are gropings, you see, in this direction. What is the whole of the globe, you see, meant to develop in division of labor?
You just begin to think about this. You read such things as in the papers that there will be 4 billion people in 2000, you see, and we won't be able to feed them. That's some such starting point to make us think in terms of territory, settlement, harvest, prosperity, you see, for the whole world, and no longer in free independence and independent little states and nations, you see, everybody to himself. See what happens in the Viet Minh. They are certainly in their good right in asking 19th century independence. The very moment they ask independence, they have to fight, line up with the communists, you see, in order to be integrated into a bigger whole. So there you have the idealism of the 19th century telescope, you see, with the facts of the times after this world war. In 1990, the Viet Minh still could have defended themselves against the French and become a small nation like Belgium or Korea, you see. And now it doesn't help them. I think they are right against the French, and they are wrong because they are dependent on the communists. It's a very tragic situation. It's a double situation. You see, time doesn't stand still. History is something that has to be fulfilled. You have just closed one chapter and the next is already, you know. That doesn't mean that one is meaningless. They all have to be told and all have to be written, and the pages of history form one complete book. So, I suggest, gentlemen, that we shall, perhaps this year, it's arbitrary, or this period, should we call in our textbooks a transition from Greece to the empire building, to the eternal settlement, to the fact that the earth is the Lord's, and that we have to speak of the earth from now on, you see, instead of speaking of independence and of our country. It's meaningless today to speak of one's country if one has to throw atom bombs on one's neighbors. It's a very doubtful proposition to speak anymore of God's country. But God's country is very meaningful for the people who came here, you see, out of this world, as it was at that time. So we have here a third period, or a fourth period. We have the 17th century, gentlemen, the church. The 18th century, Jerusalem. The 19th century, Greece. Now the 20th century, I call it Egypt. It's the nearest and it has the greatest amount of authority on its side. But Mick is, of course, the same as China or any of these empires. And we may expect that we have only delayed the dream of primitive men. Certainly already we feel that under the impact of the machine age, gentlemen, you and I have to become more complete people, or we will be just cogs on the wheel. So the next issue, the tribal issue, will be as simultaneous to Egypt as the Methodists have been to the Freemasons. That is, as Jerusalem and Greece have competed, in fact, and have not just been one after the other, and so in the same sense, the Egyptian issue, the division of labor all over the globe, and the integration of men into his ecstatic and fiery existence of a poet and a seer and a prophet of all the great arts of primitive man, and will go hand in hand. Still, I think it is wise at this moment for me to go slow and to say that although both issues, the imperial
and the tribal are simultaneous, we first of all are still settled with the division of labor more than with the other. You see, in 1776, you can say that religion and the religious life of the people in this country and the great forms of thinking in politics, forming a democracy, they're about 50-50. Yet you will admit that the spirit was then, at the first moment, being strictly secular. The 4th of July is a secular holiday. Continental Congress was good week, rhetoric and politics, you see the Declaration of Independence, these were all secular political documents. But in 70 years before, you still have religious documents, the revival, John Wesley, Charles Wesley, and so on. And the great Jonathan Edwards, the great religious tradition in this country, revived and re-strengthened. So, yet if you ask me what leads in the 18th century in this country, Greece or Jerusalem, it's very hard to answer. They are the Methodists very strong, and they are the Freemasons very strong. And the Freemasons stand for, as I said, for the secular spirit, and the Methodists for the Jewish spirit. The same is true today. You will have two parties in this country, practically. The people who care for the prosperity, and thereby for the Egyptian issue, and feel responsible. And at this moment, as you know, they are in the forefront. The whole cabinet is nothing but ministers of Pharaoh for prosperity. And that's a great responsibility of financing our budget, re-economizing the whole energies of the globe. And this tribal socialistic issue is obviously at this moment in the second rank. But it's there. And I want you to understand, gentlemen, that if you formulate capital and labor, you are trying, with some other superficial terms, to define Egypt and tribe. The social trend is the tribal one, and the capitalistic one is the Egyptian one. And I use these clear historical parallels in order to shake you up out of your complacency to thinking that capital and labor are 19th century problems or 20th century problems. They are, of course, eternal problems, you see. And God didn't create capital and labor, but he did create factories and harvests and seed time. And he did create the division of labor, because he did create the division of the sexes and of his talents and of his gifts on mankind. And I think that the words capital and labor are blinding you to the historical situation of this country. They're very short-sighted, short of breath, as though capital and labor was an invention of the American people. Sometimes you really think you have to take an oath on capitalism. You don't have to take an oath of capitalism, because God created the necessity of the great enterprise. That has nothing to do with men's will, men's intentions. The Americans have not invented capitalism, it comes from elsewhere, and they have created capitalism because it's a part of the way in which we have to use God's energies. And so nobody can ideologically promise to be a lover of capitalism. Just as little as you can be condemned to love your belly or you love your part of your body, that's just what you have. There's nothing special to love about it, only to respect it and to recognize it and to work with it. So that's the end of my story today, gentlemen. That capital and labor were the foreshortenings in perspective from the Greek point of view of this great background of our existence on this earth, that we have to amass energy, that we have to brew the energies, the raw materials, and the human forces in tremendous agglomerations and also dissolve them again. And capital and labor are, so to speak, tagging labors of the essential problem of the settlement of the blow. Much more terminal and goes much more through history than this question of capital and labor seems to insinuate. And please don't believe that capital and labor are modern. They are mean that we have to go back to something that has dominated human existence when the castes and the classes were invented, when the division of labor was invented. And they are accused, the liberal thinkers, that they have obscured this whole reverent attitude towards the world in which we have to move by thinking it was a construction of the human mind, capital and labor. That isn't so. Can you now understand that capital and labor are really the two forms in which Egypt and the tribes knocked at our door? Labor, that's the team, that's the integrated group of one spirit, of one faith. And capital, that is the power to build pyramids, to administer harvests, to prepare stones in the desert of Nubia to be used 4,000 miles away at the other end of the country for building temples to the heavens, which are the same everywhere. That's capital. So have I succeeded? I doubt it, gentlemen, but it was my great ambition to fill you with some more reverence for American history. American history is not an accident, and American history is not American history. But American history is the continuation of men's tremendous effort to do justice to the constellations under which he has been created. He has been created to be the same man at all times. He has been created to be the same man in all places, everywhere and all the time. That's your human problem. He has to be created to know of each other and to speak to each other in one religion and one faith at all times and over all places. That's the Jewish problem. And he has been created to be patient about the transient and temporary divisions that still obtain. That's the Greek problem. The Greek problem says we are many and we aren't yet one. The Jewish problem is we must be one. Tell me that we are still many. Now, the Americans are settled with this whole heritage, gentlemen, of these four attitudes. We are many, and we have to be patient that we still are many. They are so different. There are so many races here, so many religions. And that's Greek to say, well, a little Methodist and a little Baptist and a little Catholic and a little Episcopal, it's all right. You see? Still, on the other hand, you must be impatient and say, at one time, all these partitions should fall. In our heart of heart, we cannot believe in them, that they last to the judgment day. Isn't that true? That's the messianic hope. That's the impatience. The third thing is, we do live as part of the whole economy of the earth. That's your Egyptian problem. And the last is, we must, every one of us, feel the whole energy and genius of men above us and in us. We must dance and shout with joy like the morning star, and we cannot be satisfied of having just a job and for the rest having hobbies. That's very impossible, too. Now, gentlemen, the Christian solution in all these four is very different from the Egyptian, very different from the Jewish, very different from the Greek, and very different from the Red Indian one. Our economy must be able one day to come up to the whole globe. The Egyptians thought if they had their country, they had to care for the rest, and they could build a Chinese wall around it. You cannot believe in a Chinese wall for American economy.
that the Christian element in the new economy to come, it must be in some form or other include the backward nations.
Listen now, we talked about South America, for example.
You cannot omit them from the picture. You cannot build an American economy. So, gentlemen, here you have the difference of American history from ancient history. In the economic picture, America cannot be a world of its own. But our economic thinking must come up to the earth as created by the Lord. We must be global. Economically, we already do it with the oil coming from Arabia, which just means that we do it. The Russians scrape together all the uranium they can find in German Saxony, because they too are forced to have an economy which is much larger than their political union. What is Christian, gentlemen, in the three other fields of human endeavor? Why is this not just Jerusalem rebuilt? Why is it not Greek rebuilt? Well, the Greeks had 158 states, as you know, and 158 wars per annum. We have 48 states in eternal peace. Our Greek solution is one of a peaceful Sinusoid. That is, we have absorbed the Greek problem of equality of units, of nations, but we have also this Christian dream that it hasn't to be eternal war, that there is a region between them. There again, gentlemen, an ancient element, a way of life of antiquity, has been reopened by the Christian way of life and totally transformed. Just as our economy is not the Egyptian economy, and yet it is economy. But the change is that our economic thinking must encompass the real world as created by the Lord and not invented by Egyptian priests and living. In the same sense, the Greek free cities perished by constant war between Sparta and Athens and Thebes and so on. This is not true today. It's not only the 48 states, gentlemen, that gives you hope that a different solution is possible, but the world wars themselves have reduced the number of belligerents to two. That's a very hopeful situation. Everybody stresses the terror of the situation. I would tell you that, first of all, it is very nice to know that all these little entities, you see, are just out of the running. Don't you think that's a tremendous step forward? I think it is. It's the abolition of the anarchy of Greece. In Ireland, too, you know, every spring, every Irish prince had to go and steal some cows from the neighboring tribe and go to war with the neighboring tribe, and it was just a ritual. War was eternal, the war part. I don't think we believe that. I will next time then show you, finally, what the transformation of the four pre-Christian forms is in our era. We have, in America, gentlemen, are faced with this very grave solution. You can either relapse now into antiquity and have an isolated American, for example, then we go Egypt. Or you can affirm the double standard that you are reviving Egypt in the Christian era. Then you have to keep the Christian element and the Egyptian element and blend them into something that hasn't existed before.